This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Let Me Lie by Claire McIntosh. Read for you by Gemma Whelan. Part 1. Chapter 1. Death does not suit me. I wear it like a borrowed coat. It slips off my shoulders and trails in the dirt. It is ill-fitting. Uncomfortable. I want to shrug it off, to throw it in the cupboard and take back my well-tailored clothes. I didn't want to leave my old life, but I'm hopeful for my next one. Hopeful I can become someone beautiful and vibrant. For now, I am trapped, between lives, in limbo. They say sudden goodbyes are easier, less painful. They're wrong. Any pain saved from the lingering goodbyes of a drawn-out illness is offset by the horror of a life stolen without notice, a life taken violently. On the day of my death, I walked the tightrope between two worlds, the safety net in tatters beneath me. This way safety, that way danger. I stepped. I died. We used to joke about dying, when we were young enough. Still vital enough for death to be something that happened to other people. "Who do you think will go first?" you said one night, when the wine had run dry and we lay by the electric fire in my rented Balham flat. An idle hand stroking my thigh softened your words. I was quick to answer. "You, of course." You aimed a cushion at my head. We'd been together a month, enjoying each other's bodies, talking about the future as though it belongs to someone else. No commitment, no promises, just possibilities. "Women live longer," I grinned. "It's a well-known fact, genetic, survival of the fittest. Men can't cope on their own." You grew serious, cupped my face in your hand and made me look at you. Your eyes were black in the half-light. The bars of the fire reflected in your pupils. "It's true." I moved to kiss you, but your fingers held me still, pressure on my chin as your thumb pushed against bone. "If anything happened to you, I don't know what I'd do." The briefest chill, despite the fierce heat from the fire. Footsteps on my grave. "Give over." "I'd die too," you insisted. I put a stop to your youthful dramatics then, reaching to push aside your hand and free my chin, keeping my fingers tangled with yours so the rejection didn't sting. Kissing you, softly at first, then harder, until you rolled backwards and I was lying on top of you, my hair curtaining our faces. You would die for me. Our relationship was young, a spark that could be snuffed out as easily as coaxed into flames. I couldn't have known you'd stop loving me, that I'd stop loving you. I couldn't help but be flattered by the depth of your feeling, the intensity in your eyes. You would die for me. And in that moment, I thought I might die for you, too. I just never thought either of us would have to. Chapter 2. Anna. Ella is 8 weeks old. Her eyes are closed, long, dark lashes brushing apple cheeks that move up and down as she feeds. One tiny hand splays across my breast like a starfish. I sit, pinned to the sofa, and think of all the things I could be doing while she feeds. Reading, watching television, an online food shop. Not today. Today is not a day for the ordinary. I watch my daughter, and after a while, her lashes lift, and she fixes navy eyes on me, solemn and trusting. Her pupils are deep pools of unconditional love, my reflection small but unwavering. Ella's sucking slows. We gaze at each other, and I think how motherhood is the best-kept secret, how all the books, all the films, all the advice in the world could never prepare you for the all-consuming feeling of being everything to one tiny person. Of that person being everything to you. I perpetuate the secret, telling no one. Because who would I tell? Less than a decade after leaving school, my friends share their beds with lovers, not babies. Ella's still gazing at me. But gradually, the focus in her eyes blurs, the way morning mist creeps over a view. Her lids drop once, twice, then fall closed. Her sucking, always so ferocious at first, and then rhythmic, relaxed, slows, until several seconds elapse between mouthfuls. She stops. She sleeps. I lift my hand and gently press my index finger onto my breast, breaking the seal between my nipple and Ella's lips, then pull my nursing bra back into place. Ella's mouth continues to move for a while, then sleep takes her deeper, her lips frozen into a perfect O. I should put her down. Make the most of however long she will sleep. 10 minutes? An hour? We are a long way from any kind of routine. Routine. The watchword of the new mother. The single topic of conversation at the postnatal coffee mornings my health visitor bullies me into attending. Is she sleeping through yet? You should try controlled crying. Have you read Gina Ford? I nod and smile and say, I'll check it out. Then I gravitate towards one of the other new mums. Someone different. Someone less rigid. Because I don't care about routine. I don't want to leave Ella crying while I sit downstairs and post on Facebook about my parenting nightmare. It hurts to cry for a mother who isn't coming back. Ella doesn't need to know that yet. She stirs in her sleep, and the ever-present lump in my throat swells. Awake, Ella is my daughter. When friends point out her similarities to me, or say how like Mark she is, I can never see it. I look at Ella, and I simply see Ella. But asleep I see my mother. There is a heart-shaped face hiding beneath those baby-plump cheeks, and the curve of their hairline is so alike I know that, in years to come, my daughter will spend hours in front of a mirror, attempting to tame the one tiny section that grows differently to the rest. Do babies dream? What can they dream of, with so little experience of the world? I envy Ella her sleep, not only because I am tired in a way I never experienced before having a baby, but because when sleep comes, it brings with it nightmares. My dreams show me what I can't possibly know. Supposition from police reports and coroner's court. I see my parents, their faces bloated and disfigured from the water. I see fear on their faces as they fall from the cliff. I hear their screams. Sometimes my subconscious is kind to me. I don't always see my parents fall. Sometimes I see them fly. I see them stepping into nothing and spreading their arms and swooping low above a blue sea that sends spray into their laughing faces. I wake gently then, a smile lingering on my face, until I open my eyes and realize that everything is just the way it was when I closed them. 19 months ago, my father took a car, the newest and most expensive, from the forecourt of his own business. He drove the 10 minutes from Eastbourne to Beachy Head, where he parked in the car park, left the door unlocked, and walked towards the clifftop. Along the way, he collected rocks to weigh himself down. Then, when the tide was at its highest, he threw himself off the cliff. 7 months later, consumed with grief, my mother followed him. With such devastating accuracy, the local paper reported it as a copycat suicide. I know all these facts because on 2 separate occasions I heard the coroner take us through them, step by step. I sat with Uncle Billy as we listened to the gentle but painfully thorough account of 2 failed coastal rescue missions. I stared at my lap while experts proffered views on tides, survival rates, death statistics, and I closed my eyes while the coroner recorded the verdict of suicide. My parents died 7 months apart, but their linked deaths meant the inquests were held the same week. I learned lots of things on those 2 days, but not the only thing that mattered. why they did it. If indeed they did do it. The facts are unarguable. Except that my parents were not suicidal. They were not depressed, anxious, fearful. They were the last people you would expect to give up on life. Mental illness isn't always obvious, Mark says when I raise it, his voice giving no hint of impatience that the conversation is, once again, circling back to this. The most capable, the most upbeat people can have depression. Over the last year, I've learned to keep my theories to myself, not to give voice to the cynicism that lies beneath the surface of my grief. No one else has doubts. No one else feels unease. But then, maybe no one else knew my parents the way I did. The phone rings. I let the answer phone pick up, but the caller doesn't leave a message. Immediately, I feel my mobile vibrate in my pocket, and I know even before I look that it's Mark calling. Under a sleeping baby, by any chance? How did you guess? How is she? Feeding every half an hour? I keep trying to start dinner and not getting anywhere. Leave it. I can do it when I get home. How are you feeling? There's a subtle change of tone that no one else would notice. A subtext. How are you feeling today, of all days? I'm okay. I can come home. I'm fine, really. Mark would hate to leave his course halfway through. He collects qualifications the way other people collect beer mats or foreign coins. So many letters they no longer fit after his name. Every few months, he prints new business cards, and the least important letters fall off the end into oblivion. Today's course is The Value of Empathy in the Client-Counselor Relationship. He doesn't need it. His empathy was evident the second I walked through his door. He let me cry, pushed a box of tissues towards me and told me to take my time, to begin when I was ready and not before. And when I stopped crying, but still couldn't find the words, he told me about the stages of grief. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And I realized I hadn't moved past first base. We were four sessions in when Mark took a deep breath and told me he couldn't treat me anymore, and I asked if it was me, and he said there was a conflict of interest, and this was terribly unprofessional, but would I like to have dinner sometime? He was older than me, closer to my mum's age than my own, with a confidence at odds with the nerves I now saw hovering beneath the surface. I didn't hesitate. I'd love to. Afterwards, he said he felt guiltier about interrupting my counseling than about the ethics of dating a patient. Former patient, I pointed out. He still feels uncomfortable about it. People meet in all sorts of places, I remind him. My parents met in a London nightclub. His met in the frozen food section at Marks and Spencer. And he and I met in a seventh-floor apartment in Putney, in a consultation room, with leather chairs and soft woolen throws, and a sign on the door that said, Mark Hemmings, counsellor, by appointment only. If you're sure, give Ella Bella a kiss from me. Bye. I hang up first, and I know he has the handset pressed against his lips, the way he does when he's deep in thought. He'll have gone outside to make the call, forgoing coffee or networking or whatever 30 counsellors do when they're released from the classroom. In a moment, he'll rejoin the others, and he'll be lost to me for the next few hours as he works on displaying empathy for a made-up problem. Pretend anxiety. A fictional bereavement. He'd like to work on mine. I don't let him. I stopped seeing a therapist when I realized all the talking in the world wasn't going to bring back my parents. You reach a point where the pain you feel inside is simply sadness, and there's no cure for that. Grief is complicated. It ebbs and flows and is so multifaceted that unpicking it makes my head hurt. I can go for days without crying, then barely be able to breathe for the sobs that rack my body. One moment I'll be laughing with Uncle Billy about something stupid Dad once did. The next I'll be filled with rage for his selfishness. If Dad hadn't killed himself, Mum wouldn't have done either. The anger is the worst part of all of this. The white-hot fury. And the guilt that inevitably follows. Why did they do it? I've gone over the days preceding my dad's death a million times, asked myself if we could have done anything to prevent it. Your dad's missing. I'd frowned at the text, looking for the punchline. I lived with my parents, but I was away overnight at a conference in Oxford, chatting over morning coffee with a colleague from London. I excused myself to call her. What do you mean, missing? Mum wasn't making sense. The words came slowly, as though she was dredging them up. They'd had an argument the night before. Dad had stormed off to the pub. So far, so normal. I had long since accepted the storminess of my parents' relationship. The squalls that would pass over as quickly as they blew in. Except, this time, Dad hadn't come home. I thought he might have slept at Bill's, she said. But I'm at work now and Bill hasn't seen him. I'm out of my mind, Anna. I left the conference straight away. Not because I was worried about Dad, but because I was worried about Mum. They were careful to keep the causes of their arguments from me, but I'd picked up the aftermath too many times. Dad would disappear, off to work, or to the golf course, or to the pub. Mum would hide in the house, pretending to me she hadn't been crying. It was all over by the time I got home. Police in the kitchen, their hats in their hands. Mum shaking so violently they'd called a paramedic to treat her for shock. Uncle Billy white with grief. Laura, Mum's goddaughter, making tea and forgetting to add milk. None of us noticing. I read the text Dad had sent. I can't do this anymore. The world will be a better place without me in it.
Your father took a car from work.
The policeman was about Dad's age, and I wondered if he had children. If they took him for granted.
The cameras show it heading towards Beachy Head, late last night.
My mother let out a stifled cry. I saw Laura move to comfort her, but I couldn't do the same. I was frozen. Not wanting to hear, but compelled to listen all the same.
Officers responded to a call out around 10 o'clock this morning.
PC Pickett stared at his notes. I suspected it was easier than looking at us.
A woman reported seeing a man fill a rucksack with rocks and place his wallet and phone on the ground before stepping off the edge of the cliff.
And she didn't try to stop him!
I hadn't meant to shout, and Uncle Billy put a hand on my shoulder. I shook him off, turned to the others.
She just watched him jump!
It all happened very quickly. The caller was very upset, as you can imagine. PC Pickett realized his poor judgment too late to bite his tongue.
She was upset, was she? How did she think Dad was feeling?
I whirled round, searching for support in the faces around me, then fixing my gaze on the police officers.
Have you questioned her?
Anna, Laura spoke quietly.
How do you know she didn't push him?
Anna, this isn't helping anyone. I was about to snap back, but I looked at my mother, leaning into Laura, moaning softly. The fight left me. I was hurting, but Mum was hurting more. I crossed the room and kneeled beside her, reaching for her hand and feeling tears wet my cheeks even before I knew they'd left my eyes. My parents were together for 26 years. They lived together and worked together. And despite all their ups and downs, they loved each other. PC Pickett cleared his throat.
The description matched Mr. Johnson. We were on the scene within minutes. His car was recovered from Beachy Head car park, and on the edge of the cliff we found.
He tailed off, indicating a clear plastic evidence bag in the center of our kitchen table, in which I could see Dad's mobile phone and his tan leather wallet. Out of nowhere, I thought of the joke Uncle Billy always cracked about the moths in Dad's jacket pockets, and for a second, I thought I was going to burst into laughter. Instead, I cried, and I didn't stop for 3 days. My right arm, squashed beneath Ella, has gone to sleep. I slide it out and wiggle my fingers, feeling the tingle as the blood returns to the extremities. Suddenly restless, I extricate myself from beneath Ella's sleeping body with the newly acquired mothering stealth skills of a Royal Marine, and barricade her onto the sofa with cushions. I stand up, stretching out the stiffness that comes from too much sitting down. My father had never suffered from depression or anxiety. "Would he have told you, even if he did?" Laura said. We were sitting in the kitchen, Laura, Mum and me. The police, neighbours, everyone had gone, leaving us sitting numbly in the kitchen, with a bottle of wine sour on our tongues. Laura's point was a valid one, even if I didn't want to acknowledge it. Dad came from a long line of men who believed talking about feelings meant you were a poof. Whatever the reasons, his suicide came from nowhere and plunged us all into grief. Mark, and his replacement, once one had been found, encouraged me to work through the anger I felt in relation to my father's death. I seized upon five words uttered by the coroner. While not of sound mind. They helped me separate the man from the act, helped me understand that Dad's suicide wasn't about hurting those he was leaving. Rather, his final text message suggested a genuinely held belief that we might be happier without him. Nothing could have been further from the truth. Harder than coming to terms with my dad's suicide was what happened next. Trying to fathom why, after experiencing firsthand the pain of bereavement by suicide, of watching me cry for my beloved father, my mother would knowingly put me through it again. Blood hums in my ears, like a wasp trapped against glass. I walk into the kitchen and drink a glass of water, fast, then press my hands onto the granite worktop and lean over the sink. I hear Mum singing as she washes up, nagging Dad to clear up after yourself once in a blue moon. Clouds of flour as I made clumsy cakes in Mum's heavy earthenware bowl. Her hands around mine, shaping biscuits, making pastry. And later, when I came back home to live, taking turns to lean against the arger while the other made supper. Dad in the study, or watching TV in the sitting room. We women in the kitchen, through design, not default. Chatting as we cooked. It's in this room I feel most close to Mum. In this room, it hurts the most. A year ago. Today. Grieving widow plunges to her death, read the Gazette. Chaplain calls for media blackout on suicide hotspot, read the unwittingly ironic Guardian headline. You knew, I whisper, feeling sure that talking out loud is not the action of a sane mind, yet being unable to contain it for a second more. You knew how much it hurt. And you still did it. I should have listened to Mark and planned something for today. A distraction. I could have called Laura, had lunch, gone shopping, anything that didn't involve moping around the house, going over old ground, obsessing over the anniversary of Mum's death. There's no logical reason why today should be any harder than any other. My mother is no more dead than she was yesterday. No more dead than she will be tomorrow. And yet, I take a deep breath and try to snap out of it. Put my glass in the sink and tut loudly, as though an audible admonishment to myself will make a difference. I will take Ella to the park. We can go the long way round to kill time, and on the way back we'll pick up something for supper. And before I know it, Mark will be home, and today will be almost over. This abrupt decisiveness is a familiar trick, but it works. The ache in my heart lessens, and the pressure behind my eyes fades away. Fake it till you make it, Laura always says. Dress for the job you want, not the job you have, is another favorite. She means at work. You'd have to listen very carefully to pick up on the fact that her public school accent is learned, not inherited. But the principle is the same. Pretend you're okay, and you'll feel okay. Before too long, you really will be okay. I'm still working on the last bit. I hear the squeak that means Ella is awake. I'm halfway across the hall when I see something poking through the letterbox. It's either been delivered by hand, or it got caught in the letterbox when the postman did his rounds. Either way, I didn't see it when I collected the post from the mat this morning. It's a card. I received two others this morning, both from school friends more comfortable with grief when held at arm's length. And I'm touched by the number of people who note dates in this way. On the anniversary of Dad's suicide, someone left a casserole on my doorstep with the briefest of notes. Freeze or reheat. Thinking of you. I still don't know who it's from. Many of the condolence cards that arrived after my parents' deaths came with stories of the cars they'd sold over the years. Keys handed to overconfident teens and over-anxious parents. Two-seater sports cars traded for family-friendly estates. Cars to celebrate promotions, big birthdays, retirements. My parents played a part in many different stories. The address is typed on a sticker, the postmark a smudge of ink in the top right-hand corner. The card is thick and expensive. I have to wiggle it out of its envelope. I stare at the image. Bright colors dance across the page, a border of lurid pink roses with intertwined stems and glossy green leaves. In the center, two champagne glasses clink together. The greeting is embossed and finished with glitter. Happy anniversary. I recoil as if I've been punched. Is this some kind of sick joke? A mistake? Some well-meaning, short-sighted acquaintance mistaken in their choice of missive? I open the card. The message is typed, cut from cheap paper and glued to the inside. This is no mistake. My hands shake, making the words swim in front of my eyes. The wasp in my ears buzzes louder. I read it again. Suicide. Think again. Chapter 3. It wasn't the way I wanted to go. Not the way I always thought I'd go. If I imagined my death, I pictured a darkened room. Our bedroom. Pillows plumped behind my back. A glass of water touched to my lips once my own hands became too weak to hold it. Morphine to manage the pain. Visitors tiptoeing in, single file, to say their goodbyes. You, red-eyed but stoic, absorbing their kind words. And me, gradually more asleep than awake, until one morning I never woke up at all. I used to joke that in my next life I wanted to come back as a dog. Turns out you don't get that much choice. You take what you're given, whether it suits you or not. A woman just like you, older, uglier, that or nothing. It feels strange to be without you. 26 years we were together, married for almost as long, for better or for worse. You in a suit, me in an Empire Line dress, picked to hide a 5-month-old bump. A new life together. And now it's just me. Lonely. Scared. Out of my depth in the shadows of a life I once lived to the full. Nothing worked out the way I thought it would. And now this. Suicide. Think again. The words aren't signed. Anna won't know who they're from. But I do. I've spent the last year waiting for this to happen, fooling myself that silence meant safety. It doesn't. I can see the hope on Anna's face, the promise of answers to the questions that keep her awake at night. I know our daughter. She never would have believed that you and I would have stepped off that cliff of our own free will. She was right. I see, too, with painful clarity, what will happen now. Anna will go to the police. Demand an investigation. She'll fight for the truth, not knowing that the truth hides nothing but more lies. More danger. Suicide. Think again. What you don't know can't hurt you. I have to stop Anna going to the police. I have to stop her finding out the truth about what happened, before she gets hurt. I thought I'd seen the last of my old life, the day I drove to Beachy Head, but I guess I was wrong. I have to stop this. I have to go back down. Chapter 4 Anna I ring Mark back, leave a message about the car that makes so little sense I have to stop, take a breath, then explain myself again. Call me as soon as you get this, I finish. Suicide. Think again. The meaning is clear. My mother was murdered. The hairs on the back of my neck are still prickling, and I turn slowly around, taking in the wide stairs behind me, the open doors on either side with their floor-to-ceiling windows. No one there. Of course there isn't. But the card in my hand has unnerved me as surely as if someone had broken into the house and put it directly into my hand, and it no longer feels as though Ella and I are alone in the house. I stuff the card back into its envelope. I need to get out of here. Rita! There's a scuffle from the kitchen, followed by a skittering of claws on the tiles. The result of a rehoming appeal, Rita is part Cypress poodle, part several other breeds. She has auburn whiskers that fall over her eyes and around her mouth, and in the summer, when she's clipped, the white patches on her coat look like snow. She licks me enthusiastically. We're going out. Never one to be asked twice, Rita races to the front door, where she cocks her head and looks at me impatiently. The pram is in the hall, tucked beneath the curve of the stairs, and I push the anonymous card into the shopping basket at the bottom, covering it with a blanket, as though not seeing it changes the fact that it's there. I pick up Ella, just as she's morphing from contentment to grouchiness. Suicide. Think again. I knew it. I've always known it. My mother had a strength I wish I had a tenth of, a confidence I covet still. She never gave up. She wouldn't have given up on life. Ella roots for my breast again, but there's no time. I don't want to be in the house for another minute. Let's go and get some fresh air, shall we? I find the change bag in the kitchen, check for the essentials, nappies, wipes, muslins, and throw in my purse and the house keys. This is usually the point at which Ella will fill her nappy, or throw up her milk and require a full set of clean clothes. I sniff cautiously at her bottom and conclude that she's fine. Right, let's go. There are three stone steps that lead down from the front door to the gravelled area between the house and the pavement. Each step dips in the middle, where countless feet have trod over the years. As a child, I would jump off the bottom step, my confidence growing with my years until, accompanied by my mother's, "Do be careful," I could leap from the top step and land square-footed on the drive, my arms raised before invisible applause. Ella in one arm, I bounce the pram down the steps before pushing her inside and tucking the blankets firmly around her. The cold snap shows no sign of lifting, and the pavements glitter with frost. The gravel makes a dull crunch as frozen clumps break apart beneath my feet. Anna! Our neighbor, Robert Drake, is standing on the other side of the black railings that separate our house from his. The properties are identical. Three-story Georgian houses, with long back gardens and narrow outdoor passages that run from front to back between each house. My parents moved to Eastbourne in 1992, when my unexpected appearance had curtailed their London lives and launched them into married life. My late grandfather bought the house, two streets from where Dad had grown up, for cash. It's the only currency people listen to, Annie. And, I imagine, for significantly less than Robert paid when he bought the neighbouring property 15 years later. "I've been thinking about you," Robert says. "It's today, isn't it?" He gives a sympathetic smile and tilts his head to one side. The action reminds me of Rita, except that Rita's eyes are warm and trusting, and Robert's... "Your mother," he adds, in case I'm not following. There's a touch of impatience in his voice, as though I should be more grateful for his compassion. Robert is a surgeon, and although he has never been anything but friendly towards us, he has an intense, almost clinical gaze that makes me feel as though I'm on his operating table. He lives alone, mentioning the nieces and nephews who occasionally visit with the detachment of a man who has never had, and never wanted, children of his own. I wrap Rita's lead around the handle of the pram.
Yes, it's today. It's kind of you to remember.
Anniversaries are always tough.
I can't listen to any more platitudes. I was just taking Ella out for a walk. Robert seems glad of the change of subject. He peers through the railings.
Hasn't she grown?
There are so many blankets around Ella he couldn't possibly see, but I agree and tell him what percentile she's on, which is probably more detail than he needed.
Excellent. Jolly good. Well, I'll let you get on.
The drive is the width of the house, but only just deep enough for cars. Iron gates, never closed in my lifetime, lie flat against the railings. I say goodbye, then push the pram through the opening and onto the pavement. Across the street is a park, a grown-up space with complicated planting and signs that keep you off the grass. My parents would take it in turns to walk Rita there, last thing at night, and she strains now at the lead, but I pull her back and push the pram towards town instead. At the end of the row of townhouses, I turn right. I glance back towards Oak View, and as I do, I realize Robert is still standing on his driveway. He looks away and walks back into his house. We walk along Chestnut Avenue, where glossy railings flank more double-fronted townhouses, bay tree sentries wrapped in twinkling white lights. One or two of the huge houses on the avenue have been turned into flats, but most are still intact, their wide front doors uncluttered by doorbells and letterboxes. Christmas trees are positioned in bay windows, and I catch glimpses of activity in the high-ceilinged rooms beyond. In the first, a teenage boy flops on a sofa. In the second, small children race around the room, heady with festive excitement. At number six, an elderly couple read from their respective papers. The door to number eight is open. A woman, late 40s, I guess, stands in a French grey hall, with one hand resting lightly on the door. I nod a hello, but although she lifts a hand in greeting, the laughing smile is directed towards a gently squabbling trio wrestling a Christmas tree from the car to the house.
Careful, you're going to drop it.
Left a bit, watch the door.
A peal of laughter from the teenage girl, a wry grin from her clumsy brother.
You'll have to lift it over the railings.
Dad, directing proceedings. Getting in the way, proud of his children. For a second, it hurts so much I can't breathe. I squeeze my eyes shut. I miss my parents so badly, at different times and in ways I could never have predicted. Two Christmases ago, that would have been me and Dad with the tree. Mum mock scolding from the door. There would have been tins of roses chocolates, too much booze, and enough food to feed the 5,000. Laura, arriving with a pile of presents if she'd just started a job. IOUs and apologies if she'd just left one. Dad and Uncle Billy, arguing about nonsense, flipping a coin to settle a bet. Mum getting emotional and putting Driving Home for Christmas on the CD player. Mark would say I'm looking at the past through rose-tinted glasses, but I can't be alone in wanting to only remember the good times. And, rose-tinted or not, my life changed forever when my parents died. Suicide. Think again. Not suicide. Murder. Someone stole the life I had. Someone murdered my mother. And if they murdered Mum, it follows that Dad didn't kill himself either. My parents were murdered. I grip the handle of Ella's pram more tightly, unsteadied by a wave of guilt for the months I've raged against my parents for taking the easy way out, for thinking of themselves above those they were leaving behind. Maybe I was wrong to blame them. Maybe leaving me wasn't their choice. Johnson's car showroom is on the corner of Victoria Road and Main Street, a beacon of light at the point where shops and hairdressers give way to flats and houses on the outskirts of town. The fluttering bunting I remember from my childhood is long gone, and heaven knows what Grandad would have made of the iPads tucked under the sales rep's arms, or the huge flat screen scrolling that week's special deal. I crossed the forecourt, navigating Ella's pram between a sleek Mercedes and a second-hand Volvo. The glass doors slide soundlessly open as we draw near, warm air luring us in. Christmas music plays through expensive speakers. Behind the desk, where Mum used to sit, a striking girl with caramel skin and matching highlights taps acrylic nails on her keyboard. She smiles at me, and I catch the flash of diamante fixed to one of her teeth. Her style couldn't be more different to Mum's. Perhaps that's why Uncle Billy hired her. It can't be easy coming into work day after day. The same, but different. Like my house. Like my life.
Annie!
Always Annie. Never Anna. Uncle Billy is Dad's brother, and the very definition of confirmed bachelor. He has a handful of female friends, content with Friday night dinners and the occasional jaunt to London to see a show, and a regular poker night with the boys the first Wednesday of the month. Occasionally, I'll suggest Bev or Diane or Shirley join us for a drink sometime. Billy's response is always the same. I don't think so, Annie love. His dates never become anything more serious. Dinner is always just dinner. A drink's always just that. And although he books the nicest hotels for his trips to London and lavishes gifts upon his companion of choice, it's always months before he sees her again. Why do you keep them all at arm's length? I demanded once, after too many of what's known in our family as a Johnson G&T. Billy winked at me, but his tone was serious. Because that way, no one gets hurt. I wrapped my arms around him and inhaled the familiar mix of aftershave and tobacco, along with something indefinable that makes me bury my face in his jumper. He smells like Grandad did, like Dad did, like all the Johnson men. Only Billy left now. I pull away, decide to just come out with it. Mum and Dad didn't commit suicide. There's a look of resignation in Uncle Billy's face. We've been here before. Oh, Annie. Only this time it's different. They were murdered. He looks at me without saying anything, anxious eyes scanning my face. Then he ushers me into the office, away from the punters, and settles me into the expensive leather chair that's been here since forever. Buy cheap, buy twice, Dad used to say. Rita flops on the floor. I look at my feet. Remember how they used to dangle off the edge of the seat, and how, gradually, they stretched to reach the floor. I did work experience here, once. I was 15, encouraged to think about joining the family business, until it became clear I'd have struggled to sell water in the Sahara. Dad was a natural. What is it they say? Ice to Eskimos. I used to watch him sizing up customers. Prospects, he called them. He'd take in the car they were driving, the clothes they wore, and I'd see him select the right approach like he was choosing from a menu. He was always himself, always Tom Johnson. But his accent would slide a few notches up or down, or he'd declare himself a devotee of Watford FC, The Cure, Chocolate Labradors. You could pinpoint the moment the connection happened, the second the customer decided they and Dad were on the same wavelength, that Tom Johnson was a man to be trusted. I couldn't do it. I tried mimicking Dad, tried working with Mum on the desk and copying the way she smiled at customers and asked after their kids, but it sounded hollow, even to me. I don't think our Annie's cut out for sales, Billy said, not unkindly, when my work experience was up. No one disagreed. Funny thing is, sales is exactly where I've ended up. That's what charity work comes down to in the end, after all. Selling monthly donations, sponsored children, legacies and bequests. Selling guilt to those with the means to help. I've been with Save the Children since I left uni, and it's never once felt hollow. Turns out, I just never felt that passionately about selling cars. Billy's wearing a navy pinstripe suit, his red socks and braces lending him a Wall Street air I know is entirely deliberate. Billy does nothing by accident. On anyone else, I'd find the bling crass, but Billy wears it well, even if the braces are straining over his stomach slightly, with a touch of irony that makes him endearing rather than flashy. He's only 2 years younger than Dad, but his hairline shows no sign of receding, and what grey there might be around his temples is carefully touched up. Billy takes the same pride in his appearance as he does in the showroom. "What's all this about, Annie?" He's gentle, the way he always was when I fell over, or when I'd had a spat in the playground. "Tough day. I've been out of sorts myself today. Be glad when it's over, to be honest. Anniversaries, eh? Full of memories." Beneath the brusqueness, there's a vulnerability that makes me vow to spend more time with him. I used to come by the showroom all the time, but since Mum and Dad died, I've made excuses, even to myself. I'm too busy, Ella's too small, the weather's too bad. Truth is, it hurts to be here. But that isn't fair. "Come for supper tomorrow night." Billy hesitates. "Please?" "Sure. That would be nice." The glass between Billy's office and the showroom is tinted one way, and on the other side of it, I see one of the salesmen shaking hands with a customer. He glances towards the office, hoping the big boss is watching. Billy nods approvingly, a mental note filed away for the next appraisal. I watch him, looking for the tell, trying to read his mind. Trade's been slow. Dad was the driving force, and his death hit Uncle Billy hard. When Mum went too, there was a moment when I thought he was going to fall apart. I'd not long discovered Ella was on the way, and I'd come down to the showroom to see Uncle Billy, only to find the place in disarray. The office was empty, and disposable coffee cups littered the low tables in the waiting area. Customers wandered unaccompanied between the cars on the forecourt. At reception, Kevin, a newish sales rep with a shock of ginger hair, perched on the desk, flirting with the receptionist, an agency temp who had started the week after Christmas. "But where is he?" Kevin shrugged. "He didn't come in today." "And you didn't think to call him?" In the car on the way to Billy's place, I ignored the rising panic in my chest. He'd taken a day off, that was all. He wasn't missing. He wouldn't do that to me. I rang the bell, hammered on the door, and just as I was fumbling in my bag for my mobile, my lips already forming the words familiar from my parents' inquest, "This is a fear for welfare," Billy opened the door. Fine red lines covered the whites of his eyes. His shirt was open, his suit jacket crumpled enough to tell me he'd slept in it. A waft of alcohol hit me, and I hoped it was from the previous evening. "Who's running the shop, Uncle Billy?" He stared past me to the street, where an elderly couple were making slow progress along the pavement, a wheeled shopping basket in their wake. "I can't do it. I can't be there." I felt a surge of anger. Didn't he think I wanted to give up? Did he think he was the only one finding this hard? Inside, the house was a mess. A greasy film covered the glass-topped coffee table in the sitting room. Dirty plates littered the kitchen surfaces. Nothing in the fridge but a half-empty bottle of white wine. It wasn't unusual to find no proper meals in the house. Uncle Billy considered eating out to be the primary advantage of single life. But there was no milk, no bread, nothing. I hid my shock, dumped the plates in the sink, wiped the counters and picked up the post from the hall floor. He gave me a tired smile. "You're a good girl, Annie." "You're on your own with the laundry. I'm not washing your underpants." My anger had passed. This wasn't Billy's fault. It wasn't anyone's fault. "I'm sorry." "I know." I gave him a hug. "You need to get back to work, though, Billy. They're just kids." "What's the point? We had 6 punters show up yesterday, all tire kickers." "Tire kickers are just buyers who don't know it yet." Dad's favorite saying brought a lump to my throat. Billy squeezed my arm. He was so proud of you. He was proud of you, too. Proud of what the two of you achieved with the business. I waited a beat. Don't let him down.
Billy was back at work by lunchtime, putting a rocket up Kevin's arse and offering a bottle of champagne to the first rep to make a sale. I knew it would take more than champagne to get Johnson's cars on an even keel, but at least Billy was at the helm again. It was Dad who'd had the tinted glass installed, a few weeks after Grandad retired, and Billy and Dad had moved into the office, a desk on either side of the room.
Keeps them on their toes.
Keeps them from catching you having 40 winks, more like. Mum could see through the Johnson boys. Always had. Billy turns his attention back to me.
I'd have thought that man of yours would have taken today off.
It's Mark, not that man. I wish you'd give him a chance.
I will, just as soon as he makes an honest woman of you.
It's not the 1950s, Billy. Fancy leaving you on your own today. He offered to stay home. I said I was fine.
Clearly.
I was. Before this arrived. I fish in the bottom of Ella's pram for the card and give it to Billy. I watch his face as he takes in the celebratory greeting, the carefully typed message stuck inside. There's a long pause. Then he puts the card back in its envelope. His jaw tightens. Sick bastards. Before I can stop him, he's ripped the card in two and then in two again.
What are you doing?
I leap out of my chair and snatch back the torn pieces of card.
We need to take it to the police.
The police?
Think again.
It's a message. They're suggesting Mum was pushed.
Maybe Dad, too.
Annie, love, we've been through this 100 times. You don't seriously believe your parents were murdered?
Yes. My bottom lip wobbles, and I clamp it shut for a moment to regain some control.
Yes, I do. I've always thought something was wrong. I never thought either of them was capable of suicide, least of all Mum, when she knew how much Dad's death affected us all. And now
is someone shit-stirring, Annie? Some jumped-up prick who thinks it's funny to trawl the obituaries and torment grieving families? Like the shits who look through funeral listings to see when to go out burgling. They probably sent a dozen others at the same time.
Even though I know it's the sender of the card who's wound him up, it feels like his anger's directed at me. I stand up.
Even more reason for me to go to the police with it, then, so they can find out who sent it.
My tone is defensive. It's that or bursting into tears.
This family never used to run to the police. We used to sort out our own problems.
Problems?
I don't understand why Billy's being so obtuse. Doesn't he see this changes everything?
This isn't a problem, Billy. It isn't some argument you can settle out the back of the pub. It could be murder. And I care what happened to my mum, even if you don't.
Too late. I bite my tongue. Billy turns away, but not before I've seen the hurt on his face. I stand helplessly for a while, looking at the back of his head and trying to say sorry, but the words won't come. I push Ella's pram out of the office, leaving the door wide open. If Billy won't help me, I'll go to the police on my own. Someone murdered my parents, and I'm going to find out who.
Chapter 5. Murray.
Murray Mackenzie swelled a tea bag around a polystyrene cup.
Milk?
He opened the fridge and surreptitiously sniffed 3 cartons before finding one he could safely offer a member of the public in distress. And Anna Johnson was undoubtedly in distress. She was dry-eyed, but Murray felt uncomfortably certain crying was on the cards. He wasn't good with tears. He never knew whether to ignore or acknowledge them, or whether nowadays it was politically correct to offer a neatly pressed handkerchief. Murray heard a quiet murmur that could have been the precursor to sobbing. Politically correct or not, if Mrs. Johnson didn't have a tissue to hand, he would come to her aid. He didn't use a handkerchief himself,
but he had always carried one, like his father had done, for these very occasions. Murray patted his pocket, but when he turned around, the polystyrene cup over full in one hand, he realized the half-hearted squeaking noise was coming from the baby, not from Mrs. Johnson. Murray's relief was short-lived, as Anna Johnson deftly whipped the baby from its carriage and positioned it horizontally across her lap, before pulling up her top and starting to feed. Murray felt himself blushing, which made him redden even more. It was not that he objected to women breastfeeding. It was simply that he never knew where to look while they did it. He had once adopted what he'd intended to be a supportive smile towards a mother in the cafe above M&S, only to have her glare at him and cover up as though he was some sort of pervert. He fixed his gaze somewhere above Mrs. Johnson's left eyebrow as he put down her tea as reverently as if he were serving it in a bone china cup.
I couldn't find any biscuits, I'm afraid.
Tea is lovely, thank you. As Murray had grown older, he had become less and less able to judge other people's ages, with anyone the right side of 40 looking young to him, but Anna Johnson definitely hadn't seen 30 yet. She was an attractive young woman, with a slight wave to her sandy brown hair that made it bob about on her shoulders as she moved her head. Her face was pale, and showed the effects of new motherhood Murray remembered seeing in his sister when his nephews had been small. They were sitting in the small area behind the front desk of Lower Mead's police station, where a kitchenette had been installed for Murray and his colleagues to take their lunch breaks while simultaneously keeping an eye on whoever might come through the door. Members of the public weren't supposed to be on this side of the counter, but the station was quiet, and whole hours could go by without anyone coming in to report a lost dog or to sign a bail sheet. Murray had enough time alone with his thoughts at home. He didn't need silence at work, too. It was rare to see anyone above the rank of sergeant this far from headquarters, so Murray had thrown caution to the winds and shown Mrs. Johnson through to the inner sanctum. You didn't need to be a detective to know that 3 feet of melamine counter weren't conducive to making a witness feel relaxed. Not that Mrs. Johnson was likely to ever feel relaxed, given the purpose of her visit. I think my mother was murdered, she'd announced on arrival. She had eyed Murray with a determined air, as though he might be about to disagree. Murray had felt a rush of adrenaline. A murder? Who was duty DI today? Oh, Detective Inspector Robinson. That was going to rankle, reporting to a whippersnapper with fluff on his upper lip and 5 minutes in the job. But then Anna Johnson had explained that her mother had been dead a year, and that in fact a coroner had already ruled on the death and pronounced it to be suicide. That was the point at which Murray had opened the door at the side of the front desk and invited Mrs. Johnson in. He suspected there were going to be some time. A dog trotted obediently at her feet, seemingly unfazed by its surroundings. Now, Anna Johnson twisted awkwardly behind her and took a handful of paper from inside the pram. As she did, her T-shirt rode up to reveal an inch of soft stomach, and Murray coughed hard and stared fiercely at the floor, wondering how long it took to feed a baby. "Today is the anniversary of my mother's death." She spoke loudly, with a force Murray guessed was an attempt to override emotion. It made her voice strangely dispassionate, and at odds with her troubled eyes. "This came in the post." She thrust the bundle of paper at Murray.
"I'll get some gloves."
"Fingerprints. I didn't think. Will I have destroyed all the evidence?"
"Let's see what we've got first, Mrs. Johnson, shall we?"
"It's Ms., actually, but Anna is fine."
"Anna, let's see what we've got."
Murray returned to his seat and stretched the latex over his hands, in a gesture so familiar it was comforting. Putting down a large plastic evidence bag on the table between them, he laid out the pieces of paper. It was a card, crudely ripped into four.
"It didn't come like that. My uncle..."
Anna hesitated.
"I think he was upset."
"Your mother's brother?"
"Father's. Billy Johnson. Johnson's Cars on the corner of Main Street?"
"That's your uncle's place."
Murray had bought his Volvo from there. He tried to remember the man who had sold it to him. Pictured a smartly dressed fellow with hair carefully coiffured over a bald patch. It was my granddad's. Dad and Uncle Billy learned the trade with him, but they went off to work in London. That's where my parents met. When Grandad fell ill,